Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. You have a slightly different lineup today. I'm joined by Kate, coming to us all the way from what I hope is a very sunny Gibraltar. Hi, Kate, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Zach. Yeah, it was quite sunny today, though we have had some rain and we're due some more rain, but mostly sunshine.
Well, I think us sitting here in Blighty will take your occasional rain, but generally kind of very nice Spanish sunshine slash Gibraltarian sunshine, yeah, I should emphasise. Gibraltarian. Who have we got with us today? Because we are massively looking forward to this one. This one feels like it's clickbait, but actually it's really, really not. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, I was really excited when I saw this one come up. That's why I kind of jumped at the chance to co-host. So we're joined today by Richard Sugg, who did his PhD at Southampton University, a PhD in English literature. And he's since written 13 books, including Mummies, Cannibals and Vampires, and A Century of Ghost Stories. He's currently working on a book titled Talking Dirty, A History of Disgust. And today we're here to talk about the real vampires. Yes, real vampires. So, but before we talk about reality, let's talk about the legend. Most people associate vampires with Bram Stoker's Dracula, but how far back do vampire tales really go?
Yeah, this surprised me. It goes back in terms of archaeology. You have to forget written records and listen to what the archaeologists say. So 2008 in the Czech Republic, skeletons were uncovered in graves about 4,000 years old. And they've been weighted down on the head and on the chest. Other skeletons been treated as vampires or revenants will be staked through the heart. And the inference really here is that vampires are as old as fear, and in particular as old as fear of the dead. And they'll be treated in this way. The head and the heart are interesting because they're typical sites of the location of the soul. And this is as much a problem as the body, as we'll see in this very strange labyrinth of terror.
It's really interesting. It's about kind of keeping them in the ground then, basically.
It's surprisingly practical a lot of the time. Yeah. That's right. It is keeping them in the ground. It's keeping them fed. It's keeping them distracted. The ways of prevention or assault are immensely varied and sometimes quite comical.
Yeah, so even that far back, was it kind of this thing of like, you know, where you see the vampires in the films where they're clawing their way out of the grave kind of thing? Was that the case even this far back then?
That was certainly what was believed. I mean, we all come to a strange vampire of New England, which could actually feed on you without leaving the grave. That's a bit sui generis. But on the whole, yes, they were believed to come out. And there were surprisingly compelling reasons, we'll see when we get to sleep paralysis, why you really could believe that it had got out of its grave and it was right in your bedroom, actually, at night.
This is incredible. Here we are sort of all thinking that, you know, Dracula and all of that is just sort of something out of Hotel Transylvania and novels and all the rest of it. And actually, this is a concept that has embedded itself in people's minds going back literally millennia. So I guess one of the questions to talk about is why? You know, why does this legend kind of embed itself? What is it about this that really seems to get people? Do we even have equivalents? You know, so for example, you've written about mummies and cannibals, and you could, if you wanted, perhaps draw a line between cannibals and zombification. So is it just the vampire notion that really embeds itself in people's imagination, or is it many of these kind of things that we associate with the horror genre today? And what is it about vampires particularly that really gets under people's skin? And that pun is slightly intended.
They do indeed. No, mummies is a useful comparison, actually. And that's because I think one big point about vampires is they allow us to play around in the zone between life and death. So they allow us a space where we're not dead, we're not dying necessarily, but we're exploring that space, which in the end, let's face it, and we've been forced to confront this pretty radically in the last 2 years, it is the most important question in life. And mummies have that slightly zombie, slightly alive, not human quality. In the 18th century, you get a couple of plays where they romp about on the London stage spectacularly. And vampires, similarly, one of the things that really took me by surprise in this book was that a big reason why the vampire is held to exist is because for most of history, our straight kind of switch between you're alive, you're dead, did not exist and was not recognized. And for quite good reasons, for most of history and most of the world, you could be alive, you could be dead, or you could be slightly dead. And this was a dangerous zone and time, the slightly dead. People in Romania in First World War would be taken to their funeral in an open coffin so they could see and hear what was going on. You're not usually expecting them to come back, but they can do. So there's spans of time. 3 days is a crucial and the most dangerous span, particularly because the coffin will probably be open in the house and you're very keen that the soul will actually leave the house and the body. Throw windows open, you make a hole in the roof, you cover liquid so the soul won't drop in them and get drowned, etc. 40 days is crucial as well. The soul apparently going on a kind of tour of all its past life until that period. And then up to a year, in fact, is also a dangerous time. And after that, it's likely to be considered safe. So, yeah, we've got these ways in which you play around across the border between life and death. And the vampire, who is, as a kind of norm in vampire culture, is slightly dead, hopefully is going to go on and become fully dead. The vampire allows you to cross that border and make it actually much more porous and much more elastic than we might think. I found when I was answering this question many times that actually it's also worth flipping it on its head, in the sense of, you ask a kind of two-year-old kid nowadays what a vampire does, and they'll show you their teeth, I believe my niece did, and make a face, and they're indicating they drink blood. And really, actually, the question here is, why are we so fascinated with vampires or people drinking blood? Because not many of them did. Not many of them did. They simply wanted to feed on anything to keep themselves alive. The third answer to this, and this is where it gets strange and difficult, and it's taken me a long time to get my head around it. The third answer is that they've caught the imagination because some of the cases are actually real ghosts coming back, and usually poltergeists, the aggravated, the noisy, the violent, the boisterous, unhappy form of ghost. So those are the three broad answers that I was led to in this strange journey.
You've tapped into a really interesting point there, where you say it's not just about the blood, that actually the original vampires were believed to sort of feed off of anything. So where does the blood fixation come from? Is this just a literary invention, or is there some kind of connection, or even a kind of cross-pollination between stories about cannibalism and the vampire as a notion?
Yeah, the blood thing seems to take root in what I call the sort of early phase of vampotainment. So we've got running side by side the real vampires, by which I mean largely the ones people believed in. And they believed in them so badly they actually died of terror at times. And then we've got vampotainment, which obviously is very familiar to us since Polidori and onward. But actually, I think it began with factual accounts, which were a bit thrilling for an Enlightenment culture in France and Britain, which was losing religion among the educated, but kind of wanted something else. So as religion was decaying, it was a bit exciting to read about these strange magical vampire panics. And it was in this period and these accounts brought back by educated European soldiers that blood drinking did play a part. David Keyworth is a great scholar who's covered this. And people had waited too long, I suppose, for a vampire that was going to drink blood and finally get its PR act together. and they didn't really let go of it, despite the fact that you've got vegan vampires, you've got ones that are quite happy to drink milk, graze on green beans in Greek fields. Blood is the thing that sticks, and I think it's, it says something about our strange psychology, perhaps. People were more likely to be drinking blood in reality at execution scaffolds in Germany in 1865, or Denmark for that matter. But yeah, we like this idea. I suppose it's probably only got more popular with us because the world is so full of kind of dilute substances. You know, we're drinking substitute milk, sugarless Coca-Cola, etc. And here's the primal stuff. You know, here's a kind of strange engagement with the raw stuff of life. And there are a few sanguinarians in America particularly who claim they have to drink blood and they have it medically filtered and so on. They claim particular medical symptoms and they need more blood, I think, in summer than they do in winter and so on. So yeah, it's not unknown.
Right. I really want to tap into the vegan vampire thing though. Can we just, I'm sorry to jump in, Kate, can we just explore the notion of the vegan vampire? Because I think that's just brilliant.
When you say vegan vampire, do you mean like as in don't drink blood or don't, because there was a thing wasn't there in, and I didn't want to say this word, but there was a thing wasn't there in Twilight whereby they didn't drink human blood, they only drank the blood of animals, so they were sort of vegetarian, and I'm doing air quotes here, vegan. I mean, is that what you mean by vegan, or are we talking like actual vegan eats vegetables?
The best case for this really is in Greece, where you simply see a hole near the coffin, the grave, and this is almost certainly an animal getting down there. And you'll then find in the coffin, as they did in the 17th century case reported by Rico, the ambassador to Greece for Britain, that the vampire had been storing apples, nuts and grapes in its coffin. Now, this was probably an animal, but this is a brilliant little glimpse into a mindset where you are looking for vampires everywhere, you are expecting vampires everywhere, and hey presto, you are finding vampires everywhere. So this one was happily vegan, again, hadn't got its PR act together by any means, and was trying to enjoy a kind of vegan picnic down there undisturbed. But the Greeks would also talk about seeing vampires grazing on Greek beans in open daylight. Other cases, which again show you how you're looking for vampires, you're finding vampires. I think it was Greece again, where people claimed that the vampire was drinking the milk of goats at night. Now, this was either somebody going about drinking the milk because they were starving. I mean, people have done this with cows in Britain. Or more likely, it was a form of disease where the animals weren't giving milk. But this, again, is very typical. Everything that goes wrong, your scapegoat of choice in vampire country is the vampire. And we're talking bad weather, we're talking deaths, disease, animal problems, crop failure, you name it. So yeah, this sounds comical to us, but they actually shot the culprit, who was probably some wandering vagrant, had nothing whatsoever to do with it, and killed him, cut him open, and found that he had got milk in his, I can't remember now, liver probably. So it was all too serious at the time. Finally, you get to the 18th century and a few vampires start drinking blood. In these cases, it's often actually because other fluids are coming out of the mouth and you've got a darkish fluid coming out, or fluid spurts out when you stake the vampire. This will do for blood.
Okay. We've mentioned sort of the legend and the sort of vampires have been quite romanticized, haven't they, over the years? But you mentioned earlier as well the real vampires. Tell us a bit about them. Who were they? What did they look like? What did they do? I mean, why were they considered to be vampires?
Yeah, this is a key question. And if somebody looking like Bela Lugosi or Edward Pattinson starts stalking haughtily through your Serbian mud village around 1800, there's only one reason whatsoever to be frightened of him, and that's because somebody so alien and affluent looking must be your absentee landlord. The real vampires were fat, bloated with corpse gases, as shabby and unremarkable as any local peasant. But beyond that, and the fact that they kind of, you know, were sort of anti-stereotyped, as it were, these florid, chubby, discoloured, usually blackened rather than being pale and gaunt figures. Again, you've got this vampire just stout where people are expecting them, they're looking for them, they're finding them. So you end in with a bewildering range of types. I mean, it can be a dog, a cat, a hare. If you burn the vampire, you're very nervous about any birds or insects or snakes scurrying out of the flames, which of course they would do, because the vampire can be embodied in one of these. It can go down to the level of a butterfly or a moth. And one of my favorite forms of vampire staking is just pinning a moth to the wall to keep the vampire in place there. A character called Sava Savanovich had an airing again a few years ago in the press when he was supposed to have come back because they'd knocked his old home down, which was an old mill. But Sava Savanovich was thought to be a problem since they tried to destroy him in the 18th century because during the burning, a butterfly flew out of his mouth. And weird and kind of eccentric as though this might look, the key to it again is the soul, the spirit. You just need anything big enough for the vampire's soul to flit into, and that will suffice. So yes, anything at all, with the logic again, I suppose, that old religious logic that the devil is a shapeshifter, the devil is always changing his shape, and this was what the vampire would do, although bats actually disappointingly don't turn up very much.
I was going to ask that. I was going to say, is that where the bats came, you know, the thing about the bats came from?
I think Stoker probably adapted, you know, from the reality of the protean vampire in animal and insect shapes. I think he did do his research and probably made a good choice because it's kind of stark, isn't it?
I'm loving this. I'm just absolutely loving it. It's kind of, it's bizarre and it's quirky. Essentially, this is a massive scapegoating exercise, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, huge.
And it's all about othering and, you know, just go and pin the blame on somebody who looks a bit different and perhaps acts a little bit differently. And, you know, then supposedly that will solve all the problems. And the irony being, of course, that actually they're so concerned about this concept that it perhaps creates more problems than it's really worth, which is where I want to go next with the vampire panics, because these become a thing. You talked earlier about some people kind of scaring themselves to death over this. So what do these vampire panics actually involve?
So the answer to that is twofold, because firstly, you've got, of course, the question of why they think the vampire has come back. Why would a vampire be created? The biggest kind of umbrella reason is pretty much religious. Huge one in lots of places, especially Greece, was excommunication. So anybody excommunicated would be cursed by the church and their body would fail to decay. Greeks particularly did a lot of exhumations to make sure that a person had decayed, and they were traumatized if they thought that the spirit was trapped in an undecayed body. So that was a big one. Religious reasons were big. Sudden death was a big one. Unnatural death, murder, suicide, very, very big one. A lot of other magical reasons. Again, the whole thing we said about being slightly dead, that your soul is naturally lingering around, it's actually reluctant to leave the house. And sometimes you've got to encourage it to go on its way. And you meet cases of somebody at a funeral, the priest, actually knocking the vampire on the head, knocking the person on the head, telling them they are dead, reminding them they are dead, which is actually perhaps not as weird as it might seem. Among the magical reasons, if a cat or a bird passed over the body or sometimes even over the roof of the house of death, vampirism was a risk. Particularly an extraordinary one in a place called Ambeli, it's the pseudonym for Evia, little island not that far from Athens in Greece. And these superstitions or beliefs were going on well into the 20th century. A woman called Duboulet was out there studying the Evians. And a bit of an irony here was that you must not leave the body alone. You must never leave a dead body unattended. And that was a particular cause of vampirism if you had. The problem was that you must be round it constantly, 24 hours a day. You're round it in a circle. You're tired by about 3 a.m. And they remembered, the Ambelians or the Evians, to Duboulet, a case where some poor woman had passed a baby or a coffee cup over the body And then it was instantly vampirized and it was completely irrevocable. There's nothing you could do about it. And just by having passed a cup of coffee the wrong way, the result was that you actually had to pour boiling oil into the coffin and you destroyed the vampire's soul. I cannot now remember the Greek word, but there is a particular Greek word for doing this. You destroyed its soul and you then didn't remember it in any way. This is Greece we're talking about, but you didn't light any candles. You weren't saying prayers for it. That whole kind of, you know, Catholic boundary that you're crossing between the living and the dead, that was out. So if you think about this, you know, the degree of heresy here is beyond anything you could possibly imagine in official theology. You've destroyed the Christian soul and you had to do it because of a rogue coffee cup. Why did they actually happen, these panics, the kind of, you know, medical, if you like, scientific forensics? One pretty grim one, which we'll get into, it's probably not the biggest cause, but it was a real one. People simply weren't dead. They were not undead. They were not dead. They were buried alive. And this happened a lot. And if you were buried alive, unfortunately, as we'll see, the best thing was to stay down there and just wait it out. Because if you got out, that was another problem altogether. Disease was a big, big one. And as Zach is rightly saying, spot on, the scapegoating is huge. Basically, if you're in vampire territory, all the stuff that the witch was blamed for elsewhere, the vampire was blamed for. The good thing about it being that the vampire was already dead. So, you know, you're saving the lives of lots of witches here, in a sense. So, yeah, disease is a constant problem. And vampires are used to explain that. The weird one that's hard to get your head around, and if you can't, I don't at all blame you, because before I wrote this book, I could not get my head around it, is that actually real poltergeists were coming back. And certainly the thing that's easy to get your head around is that in classic vampire country, Romania, Montagu Summers has a case from, I think, about 1920, where showers of stones are being hurled at a house. I think they're barricading the windows with furniture. It gets so bad. And this is a classic poltergeist thing. So they describe the vampire as behaving like a poltergeist. And it was at this point I started thinking I better find out what poltergeists actually do. No idea at that point. These are the main reasons. Sleep paralysis will come to. That's a very big, scary one as well.
Can I ask about the religion element here, seeing as you touched on it there? Sure. Because in a lot of respects, this feels very heretical, doesn't it? Idea that you've got this, and sure, you can kind of turn around and say, oh, well, it's the devil's work, but you've got this concept of sort of somebody who's fallen in some respect, can we say? And sure, life after death, that's the whole point that religion is based upon, but it's very much sort of not the life after death that the church talks about. You know, if you are somebody who believes in purgatory, you know, this isn't purgatory, this is something very different. So when the church gets wind of all of these concepts, how do they deal with this? Because it sort of feels quite problematic in terms of what the church is trying to preach.
Yes. There are a few cases I think I've come across in Bulgaria. A couple of British soldiers were out there in the late 19th century where the priest would connive in what the locals wanted. And perhaps you're somewhere fairly remote. Actually, as a priest, your powers are a bit limited and you depend on these people for all sorts of things. But I think the biggest answer to that question, which is a key one, is that what I learned from doing this and also from books I've done on the soul is that for most people in most of history, there was nothing but magic. Actually, and they were, to me anyway, they were defiantly and quite touchingly independent of Christianity. And they were pious, they were certainly pious, but Christianity had to be useful to them. And at one level, down to the present time, I mean, I've been dealing with a poltergeist case still going on in America, where the victim of it was left out to dry by the Catholic Church. I mean, they were completely useless. So mainstream religion isn't very good at dealing with ghosts and poltergeists, but people's attitude to nature and religion was that it must work for them. So you've got people in Britain in the 19th, 20th century sprinkling holy water on their potato crop, taking the wafer out of the church, and again, putting it on their crops. And their logic is in some ways pretty good. I mean, what they're being told all the time is that this stuff is powerful. Well, if it's powerful, let's make it work for us. So, yeah, people lived in a kind of wonderful, defiant world of their own, I think. They took what was useful to them and they turned it and twisted it in all sorts of directions, which, yeah, they left official theologians and priests a lot of the time absolutely thunderstruck with, I think, quite unjustified indignation.
Is this, we've mentioned sort of certain religions and certain areas. Is this something that spreads all over the world into kind of non-Christian countries or other places? What are some of the stories about kind of the other kind of parts of the world and what happens there in terms of vampires and these kind of legends and or real cases?
Yeah, there are all over the world, really, as with fairies, as with witchcraft. There are versions pretty much the entire world, as far as I know. I didn't get into that too much because it would have made the book diffuse and also sort of gone over my word count. But yes, people that, you know, the undead, the half-dead that feed on you in India, in the Far East, it certainly does happen as well. But it does seem that Christianity really fostered this, actually. The versions we know, you get it in Russia, you get it in New England, very strange one we'll come to. You get it in most of Europe. Versions of the Revenant seem to die out of Britain, but they did come about quite a lot in the medieval period. So yeah, Greece, of course, is an intensely Christian country, and actually Greece, where Byron set his, or sorry, Byron's Polidori in the end set the Greek vampire tale, is as much a vampire heartland as anywhere, you know, as much as Transylvania or Northern Europe.
Can we kind of gain some sense of how people try and deal with vampires? One of the questions I wanted to ask was, where does the stake through the heart thing come from? And you've kind of touched on that already, but we have the stake through the heart concept. We have garlic cloves. How much of that is modern sort of almost pop culture, and how much of it is kind of based on the original practices that have come down through the mists of time?
Yeah, those are perfectly authentic, genuine ones. Garlic was used for all sorts of reasons. I think just because it was an unusual kind of powerful thing, as it used against witchcraft. The stake, coming back to what Kate was saying, very much practical thing. Pin it in its grave, keep it in its grave. But I think what's been forgotten about the staking, you had to use the right type of wood. You had to try and I haven't tried it myself, but I imagine it's quite difficult. You had to try and get the stake in one blow. And if you did it twice, then it made things worse, allegedly. But a forgotten one has been the, quite a big one, I think, preventative staking. That actually, just to be on the safe side, because the dead seem to come back quite a lot sometimes, you put the stake in at first burial. In more recent cases, where it's become taboo to exhume and treat the dead as vampires in parts of Romania, you might just do that as standard procedure so that you don't then have to suspiciously open up the grave and get into trouble with the authorities. But those are actually only two of an absolutely bewildering myriad range of solutions. The big thing, again, I think we touched on this, is be practical, use what you've got to hand, but be thorough. If it doesn't solve the problem, and sometimes if the problem is pure terror, then really this is psychosomatic. So you act, you do something, you take some drastic actions, and the problem goes away because it was a matter of pure psychological terror. But yeah, you've got cases of people in Central Europe burning up to, I think, 11 corpses. This is a lot of wood in a pre-industrial culture to expend, and must have been quite a sight when they're all blazing away on the hillside there. You chop the head off. We've got a case of a son chopping off their dead father's head somewhere. A big one that Paul Barber first pulled out, which I think still isn't very well known, is that, as Barber neatly put it, we don't know that vampires ever drank blood, but we have very persuasive evidence that people drank the blood of vampires. And they did drink the blood of a vampire, burn the heart, collect the ashes in water, drink that, burn the heart, burn the body, let the smoke pass over them, or exhale the smoke. I can pop Kate in my history of disgust here, so making a very telltale face. And yeah, people performed, coming back to what Zach mentioned earlier, forms of cannibalism or vampirism as a magical cure to rid themselves of vampires. A few of my favorite among the myriad types, there were professional vampire hunters or killers who could, and I think this was a kind of pantomime of invisible drama going on, steal the vampire's clothes, make off with them up a ladder, have the vampire invisible, chase them up the ladder, and then just push him off while they were at the top. You could bottle the vampire in Central Europe, and this involved tempting the vampire into a little bottle with some of its favorite food, which was, of course, excrement. You popped in an icon, a little religious aid there in the bottle. Once you got it in, stoppered it up, threw it on the fire, job done. And then the vampire's intelligence actually being quite limited, again, not much like the great apocalyptic cackling arch villain of recent fiction. The vampire could be asked simply to go and mind a loaf of bread on somebody else's land and would faithfully do that like a sort of dog, and not go vamping about. Or they could be told to go and catch fish from the Danube, where they would fall in and drown. So yeah, a few of the great sample. They could be brutally practical and forceful. One that's interesting because it spans such a long time and so many different locales is simply you bury the corpse upside down so that if it wakes up, decides to come and feed on you and visit you, it will only dig itself further into the ground. Again, it's not terribly clever. It will dig itself further into the ground. Now, this turned up in a case of murder around Tintern Abbey, just on the English-Welsh border here, in the 19th century. But it also turned up in the First World War, one maybe for Zach here, where a couple of British soldiers were seen by an officer taking the trouble to bury, and bury upside down, a German soldier that had just been hit by a British sniper, which was probably a bit of a risk on the World War I battlefields. But yeah, very practical, straightforward, doable solution again, I suppose.
I can't get past the burning and eating and drinking the blood and drinking the ashes, and my brain's still back there somewhere. Why would they? Why would they think that that would solve the problem? What?
I mean, the hypocrisy here, right? You know,
you can call it justice, I suppose. You call it poetic justice if they really believe it is drinking their blood, and they certainly do believe it's feeding on them. I think this is the thing to remember is, you know, get past the blood, which is happening sometimes, but the feeding is crucial. Another solution.
So they eat it back and that makes it okay.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, sometimes the logic of magic is not very easy to fathom, but I think it's a because it does show you that people will stop at nothing. That is how terrified they are. And we should be clear here, I suppose, that when a vampire panic was going on, people did actually die of terror. And people can die of fear. It's known as voodoo death. But it doesn't just happen in, you know, supposedly savage cultures. It happens all over the world. It happened in Victorian London. If someone thought they'd seen a ghost, it could literally be someone with a white sheet playing a prank. This went into court because somebody played a prank and somebody died of it. Happened many, many times. And it happened with witches. People were so terrified. It was serious enough to do something as disgusting as that. And that was still going on, incidentally, the smoke inhaling, at any rate, in New England in the late 19th century.
Wow, that's crazy.
I mean, for people who are concerned about, you know, the vampire's soul transferring to another organism, this idea that you're just going to inhale the smoke coming off of a funeral pyre just does seem to be a little bit counterintuitive, doesn't it? It's just incredible. I'm also loving the fact that we've got kind of vampire hunters. We're going to come on to versions of Buffy the Vampire Slayer in just a second. So setting aside this kind of slightly odd, slightly hypocritical, slightly illogical kind of thing that they're doing of inhaling seemingly other vampires as if that's not going to be a problem when they're concerned about, you know, the shifting of souls and all the rest of it. Let's move on from that. The connection between vampires and sleep, this is a curious one. Again, you sort of alluded to it earlier with this kind of sleep paralysis thing. Talk us through that whole vampire nightmare phenomenon.
Yes. So as it felt to them, I suppose, you're lying in bed in your Serbian mud hut in about 1800, and you've had a perfectly good sleep for a couple of hours. You wake up and you cannot move. And perhaps you've got someone next to you in the bed, but if you try to speak, you cannot speak either. And presently you become aware of something, always just kind of to the side of the vision, the corner of the eye. It might be a figure of a human, it might be the figure of a dog or a cat, but in either case, it's got a kind of aura of evil and terror about it that far exceeds any ordinary dog or cat or human. And actually, although we're in a Serbian mud village here, I'm taking some of these descriptions off a student of mine, an MA student, just about 12 years ago, had this problem in childhood. And the thing comes towards you slowly, inexorably. It gets onto the bed. Now it has weight, and this is where we're back in the territory of revenants, of things that are not airy ghosts. And in fact, of course, the word nightmare, which is the one used a lot of the time for this phenomenon, comes from partly the word mar, meaning to crush or bruise, and bruises and marks were left on victims and still were in our own century. And this is now on your chest. The problem here is that you cannot breathe properly, and the weight on the chest seems to be responsible for this. You perhaps know Fuseli's little demonic thing, solid little goblin in the painting. And it seems to go on for a tremendously long time. It's a kind of perfect storm of terror. I mean, no kind of director or writer could really have invented something so good, because you've got an awful kind of terrible heavy breathing in your ears that sounds like nothing you've ever heard. Modern victims say that it takes them years to realize this is their own breathing as they get more and more terrified. But breathlessness, doctors assure us, is one of the most terrifying things there is. But there's certainly an aura of terror which is hard to get your head around until you start listening to modern victims of sleep paralysis. And I can give you my own experiences briefly, but first off, I think more memorably, a guy called Alexis Madrigal, writing for The Atlantic magazine, he had a sleep paralysis attack in 2011, and he described himself as quite atheistical, a straight materialist, but he said the level of fear involved was not that it was trying to get at his life, it was that it was trying to get at his soul. And victims of this in the last few years, repeatedly, internet postings and so on, talk about something sucking the life out of them, but life in kind of capitals, as if it were the soul, the spirit force. A Korean soldier, this is a writer called Owen Davies, a terrific writer on the supernatural, still working now, talks about a Korean soldier suffered sleep paralysis. Now, he had been on the front line in the Korean War for 18 months, and he said never in all his life did he experience anything as terrifying as sleep paralysis. What's actually happening? Well, the medical version of this, the straightforward, calming kind of thing we tend to believe in our culture now, is that it's all very explicable. Everybody is paralyzed every night to stop them acting out their dreams. In the old days, you're lying in your cave there, you've got saber-toothed tigers stalking about. Not a good idea to start making a lot of noise to attract attention to yourself. Or even, as in modern times, the case of Lord Longford, who dreamed he was playing tennis with Martina Navratilova, saw a ball so hard that he had to hit it with his head and was woken up by his wife because he was banging his head on the furniture. Just don't act out your dreams. I bought the medical rational explanations for a while, but I don't entirely anymore. One of the things that happened to me when I was first researching this book, and it was sometime before it was published, I'd been working on sleep paralysis for a long time. I went off for a holiday in a cottage, which actually pretty old place, farmhouse in the Welsh coast, was quite possibly actually haunted. But the first ever sleep paralysis attack I had, it was a figure, humanoid, I suppose. It looked like it was made out of television snow that you used to get in the old days at the end of TV. And it was a bit spooky. I couldn't move, I couldn't talk. But in my head, being very rational about all this, I knew it down to the inch in rational terms as far as I was concerned. I just swore at it, and that did the trick. It went away. A few months later, I had another sleep paralysis attack, really frightening. And then a third one. So by the time of the third one, I was pretty blasé about this. And the detail here is quite important. I got both of my, I've got one arm under the blanket, sort of tucked in tightly, and I got the other dangling out over the edge of the bed. I woke up thinking, oh God, it's sleep paralysis, and you know, go away, go, I just lie here together, I can't say anything, can't do anything. But certainly I got one arm absolutely clamped under the blanket, the other arm dangling. And here's where we kind of need visuals, but I'll try and do this for audio. As I was lying there just thinking, yeah, yeah, get it over with, suddenly from nowhere, a hand turned up and clamped smack around my wrist. And that really made me kind of sit up and gave me a weird feeling of something thinking, well, you're not going to take this seriously. Watch this. And yeah, there are some pretty powerful sleep paralysis cases, more terrifying and more convincingly real than that. So it's a very strange area where the medical meets the supernatural. And I think actually, yeah, something really supernatural is probably going on in some cases.
Wow. That's yeah, it's it's quite scary, isn't it? I guess it can be quite frightening, and you can certainly understand. I mean, now we've got a lot of medical explanations and so on, so we kind of try to explain it away. But yeah, a few hundred years ago, when you didn't have that, it would have been absolutely terrifying.
It would have been, you know, the perfect storm of terror. And what was fascinating to me was that you're allegedly, and I think there's probably some truth in this, your cultural mindset shapes the demon that comes at you. So the three biggest demons that took shape in these experiences were the witch, the vampire, and the alien abductor. But actually, in terms of being terrified, it was probably, I'm just trying to cast my mind back here, I'm teaching students of 20 about this, in about 2014. So if you go back from there, we're talking the 1990s, three of my students out of 12 had had this problem. And one of them, to the extent it traumatized her for, I think, months during her teens, it particularly afflicts people during their teens when you got enough to worry about anyway. And we're talking here Britons, Americans, people in, you know, the most highly funded, cutting edge scientific medical culture in history, but they've got absolutely no information. In some cases, they tell their parents tell them to shut up and stop talking rubbish. They tell their doctor, and the doctor refers them on to a psychiatrist. So it was actually across the period that I was researching this. It was partly perhaps thanks to the work I was doing, but it just seemed to start spreading, I think, from grassroots, a lot of terrified teenagers on the internet. And presently you've got a documentary on it, you've got proper medical stuff when you look the terms up. But when I was first researching this, you're getting internet posts of kids who are terrified out their wits and are not really getting any help, or are getting less than no help.
So you mentioned about your kind of cultural origins shaping your own demons. There are very different versions of vampires, aren't there? So are they based according to the preoccupations of the society that's kind of created them, so to speak? Is that where they originate from?
They can be. Yeah, there's a couple of examples here. Zach rightly pointed out the dangers of looking a bit different and the scapegoating. And in Greece, you had something called the living vampire. And it takes you a while to get your head around these stories that initially look like pure folklore. So you get a case where a woman was widowed and a man came and he married her. And everyone thought at first he was normal, but he tended to go away on Saturday nights and disappear. And he tended to eat liver, which was very suspect, sign of a vampire. And presently they would examine him and they'd find something like he hadn't got any cartilage in his nostrils. They phrase it as he only had one nostril. Or anything else that was a bit odd looking. And hey presto, this character could be burned to death, quite literally, for seeming a bit different. And when you decode this, you realize that in a very, very insular culture, very gossipy, very narrow, this man simply came from another village. He was strange because of that. And it could cost you your life. In Russia, they would talk sometimes about how the vampire had stolen someone's faith. And this one really stumped me for a bit until I read into the context and the details of the problem, and you realize you're talking about mental illness. They've got exactly the same face as they used to have, but their behavior is so strange that they simply must have stolen this face. You've got some demon spirit in here causing these problems. And again, this could cost you your life. I mean, Russia was a place where you did not want to get out of your grave if you happened to have been buried alive. The other very much contextual factor in New England was that there was a crippling and cruel epidemic of consumption in America, particularly on the cold, windy northeast coast. And so in New England, throughout the 19th century, you had the vampire used as scapegoat for the problem of consumption, which ironically, as Michael Bell has pointed out, makes you look slightly vampiric in our modern sense, gaunt, eaten away by disease. This was a world where a family could lose 12 people to consumption. You have big families, but they got hacked down. Now, the fascinating thing about consumption and vampires in New England is that, and I refer you here to Michael Bell's book, which is terrific, Food for the Dead, and gives you the crucial idea of what's going on. The vampire, the consumptive, the first person in the family who died of consumption was not quite dead, and they were feeding on you from the grave. They were feeding on you from a distance. They did not need to leave the grave. And you would go and check, were they really dead? Were they really decayed? All they needed to persuade them that there was something living there was a tiny bit of blood in the heart, the lungs, what have you. This was where they might be burned, the smoke would pass over you, be inhaled, etc. But yeah, this was very much a scapegoat for an epidemic killer consumption. And the second person got it, of course, because it was passed by germs, but they didn't realize this. And the first person was responsible, and they would do pretty grim things. And it was quite a roller coaster going through Michael's book and associated research when you realized just how fiercely magical these people could be. Imagine a gathering on Woodstock Green in New England in 1830. These people, they look like well-dressed, educated, upright senators. In fact, the family who was the victim of this, one of their relatives was a US Senator, Corwin. So yeah, you imagine some sort of Abraham Lincoln lookalikes standing around on Woodstock Green. They've just exhumed a body. They've taken the heart out. They put it in a pot. They burn it to ashes. They bury it very deep. And when they've covered it over again, they sprinkle bullock's blood on the earth. Now, this is not the kind of stuff that modern American Republicans want taught in history. This messes with their idea that it is African-Americans who are the ones that practice the magic and do the dark, dangerous things down in Louisiana and New Orleans. No, this is the Abraham Lincoln types messing about with bullock's blood and burning the vampire's heart. So yeah, a couple of two or three versions there. The other version, again, which you can see if you look at the book, is the poltergeist, which is the strangest of all because it does actually seem to exist.
I'm still struggling to get over. We'll redo that because of feedback. I'm still struggling to get over the vampiric nature of the supposed cures for vampirism, if that's even a word. But I want to tap into something that you said earlier, which is about what I'm going to call vampire hunters, because there were people who were kind of playing on this kind of thing. So do we have many versions of a sort of old equivalent of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, he says deliberately tongue-in-cheek, but sort of running around early modern Europe? Do we have sort of Van Helsing type figures doing their thing?
No, you don't. The vampire hunting kits with which you're perhaps familiar would be faked up for 20th century buyers in Portobello Market or similar places in America. And they've been examined and found to be, not of the date they claim to be. And they'd also be kind of hopelessly inadequate. You know, I mean, there's simply not enough wood in a vampire hunting kit to burn him out. There isn't a spade to chop his head off, and so on. There was certainly, I think, and this is Owen Davies has again done great work on this kind of stuff, there were cunning folk, as you might know of, all over the world, certainly in Britain, well into the 20th century, who were respected for their knowledge of the occult, fairies, witches, vampires, what have you. So the kind of guy who's bottling your vampire for you, you want a professional to do that in Europe. The guy who takes the vampire's clothes and runs up the ladder, he's probably a professional. But it's all very local, and actually it's very ad hoc, because these problems kind of spring up fast. I'll give you two vivid examples. One was a village called Sarovsky in Russia in 1890, and it's winter, so it's damn cold, of course, in Russia. And probably what happened, my brother's friend was, or is still actually, an undertaker, and some years ago he had a dead tramp in his office sit up and start running around rather alarmingly, because he'd just been comatose with cold. Now, a character's being buried, quite well respected chap, died of old age seemingly in Sarovsky here. It's actually very cold, and it, as we said, he's not undead, he's simply not dead. Now, in some cases when this happened, they were so terrified they really managed to slam down the nails in the coffin and get you in there and shovel the earth on. That was your lot. That was the best way to go. The other way to go was this. The nails were wooden a lot of the time, so it wasn't actually that hard to get your coffin lid off. Then you would run out, as this poor man did, half frozen, of course, in a shroud in the Russian winter, hurtle into a house and try to warm yourself by the stove. As luck would have it, this chap hurtles into the only house where they don't actually know about the funeral, so they're not convinced that they're looking at one of the undead, but everybody else is. They're gathering in a great panic with guns and stakes, and they simply drag this poor man out, lay him down, and stake him alive. They then leave him there till sunset, where at the appointed hour he will be thrown into a bog. You think of your bog mummies that we know about, probably met similar fates. And it struck me that if you're looking at this, we're wondering with absolute astonishment what these people are doing and exposing their children to the sight of all this. I started to think, well, actually, no, we've got it the wrong way around. You're a kid and you see somebody treated like this, they must be really evil. They must be really dangerous. His body's there, staked for you to watch and wonder at until sunset comes around and chuck it in the bog. So that wasn't such a good way to go. Then you've got the actually dead vampire. And here is a case which gives us sleep paralysis again as well. A man dies just before Christmas, and presently his niece claims that he is coming back at night to her in bed and feeding on her heart. So this sense of your life being sucked out again, rather than just your blood. This is taken seriously enough that presently, after waiting an appropriate number of religious days, after Christmas in the new year, they go to the man's, called Petra's grave. They open up the grave. They decide he isn't properly decayed. They break his ribs up, get his heart out, spike it on a pitchfork, and with this aloft, they stuff burning coals into the ventricles, cause charred flakes of tissue, the heart, to drop out into, a towel, pop that in, pop the ashes in some water, give it to the girl to drink. And this might be a case where your belief can kill you, but your belief can also save you, because you've done the magic thing, which is pretty extreme, as we agreed, but these are extreme dangers, extreme measures. And yeah, this seems to work. This all went on, you'll be pleased to hear, in Transylvania, a place called Maritina de Sus. And it happened across winter 2003-04. And you might be pleased to hear also, just after Stephanie Meyer had signed her contract for Twilight.
Okay, my gob just hit the floor. Wow. I wasn't expecting that.
Me neither. No. Yeah.
The whole vampire thing has totally blown my mind, and I think Zach's as
great.
Well.
Good.
So, yeah, it'd be great to get you back and talk about ghosts next
wonderful.
Time.
No, it's been a terrific hour. Been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. And your books that have been released, I believe we'll be able to find them in the History Hack books bookshop, so everyone can check them out there. And we look forward to talking ghosts very soon.
Okay, great stuff. Yeah, the early ghost ones are A Century of Supernatural Stories and A Century of Ghost Stories. So they're out there already.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks.